We come now to week three, concluding our time in parables together. Walt will be back next week. And I am just now getting in a rhythm, I feel like. So I'm a little sad. I felt like last week I overprepared and had way too much, so we didn't get through. And I feel like this week, hopefully, we're going to hit it right on the head. So, you know, we started and did a lot of intro work the first week we were together, looking at kind of the purpose of parables and that discourse idea. And then last week we looked at the parable of the sower. And somebody came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I thought, oh, it's just the parable of the sower. I've heard this a million times. And then I walked away thinking, I don't know what this means. Which I feel like is the idea of a parable, right? It should get us really, really mulling over to try to figure out what's really going on here. And so we continue with this idea of discourse today. We're going to look at a new parable that I'm really excited about. But I wanted to start with one more little story, one little parable. And some of you may have heard this. This is an old Jewish saying, old Jewish story as well. And it's of a rabbi and a student. And the rabbi, who was in his 70s, and a young student comes up to this older rabbi and says, Rabbi, I'm ready. I've studied, and I've studied, and I've studied, and I'm ready. Teach me the wisdom of God. The rabbi, kind of put off, says, what are you, day over 20? Like, you know, come back to me when we've had a little bit of life experience, and then we can maybe talk. He said, no. I've studied, and I know Aristotelian logic, and I know it all. I'm ready to know the wisdom of God. Teach me the history of the Hebrew people and the wisdom of our tradition. He said, okay. So let me ask you a question. Two men go down a chimney. One has soot on his face and the other one doesn't. Which one washes his face? He says, well, obviously the one with the soot on his face washes his face. He says, no. See, the other one washes his face because he sees his partner has soot on his face and assumes that he has soot on his face. And so he's the one that washes his face. You're not ready for the wisdom of God. Come back to me in 20 years. He says, no. Give me another chance. He says, okay, let me ask you another question. Two men go down a chimney. One has soot on his face. One doesn't. Which one washes his face? And he says, well, right, not the guy with the soot on his face. The other guy. And he says, no, now you're just trying to be cute and think you're smart. He says, obviously, the man with the soot on his face, don't you realize he can taste it and feel it in his eyes? Of course he's the one that washes his face. Get out of here and come back to me in 20 years. He says, give me one more chance. I've got this. And he says, okay, I'll ask you a different question this time. Two men go down a chimney. One has soot on his face and one doesn't. Which one washes his face? He says, well, is it the first answer, but for different reasons? See, get it. You have no idea. Get out of here. Don't you think if two men go down a chimney, they're going to wash their face because they know they have soot on their face? Both of them are going to wash their face. Get out of here and come back here in 20 years whenever you've had a little bit of life experience. It's a fun little story, right? With the idea being, right when we think we have it, right? We read a parable, we think we understand it, we think we get it. We don't get it at all, you know? And that's the brilliance. And that's the beauty of it. The first week I talked about in the Hebrew tradition is also the idea of the 70 faces of Torah, that every time you turn that gem, you see a different face of Torah. And that's what we get with the scriptures so often. And I talked last week about this idea that what we see in the parables and so much of the readings is that it has the opportunity to open so much lovely conversation. You know, if we allow scripture to be the opportunity to open conversation for us rather than using it to shut down conversation, well, there's just an opportunity for so much growth. And so much opportunity to learn from one another. So today we're going to look at a parable that I'm sure you've heard, again, a million times. The parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. And again, remember, titles are important because just based off the title, you already have assumptions, right? You've already come up with assumptions simply based on what this has been titled. Notice that in the text, in the Greek, this isn't titled. There's just a story. The editors, people who have put the Bible together, all of us who then go out back and tell the story, we call it the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. But what are assumptions that you make simply based off of Pharisee and tax collector? Who are Pharisees? What are the assumptions we make of Pharisees typically? Powerful, wise,
high station life.
Someone just stuck their nose up in the air. Self-righteous. Yeah, typically, even like hypocrite, right, is kind of the association, a nomenclature that's often used. And we get a lot of this from the New Testament understanding of what we get with the Pharisees. Now, I'll often say In the same way that there has been a search for the historical Jesus, there probably needs to be a search for the historical Pharisees, because we don't have a lot of writings on the Pharisees. You know, Paul, the Apostle Paul, was a Pharisee, and so we have his writings. And Josephus writes a little bit about the Pharisees, but we don't actually have a whole lot about the Pharisees. And so often what we get in the Gospels, I tend to think, is kind of a caricature of what we just talked about, right? Sometimes an uprightness, snooty a little bit. But in all actuality, from what we know of Pharisees, they were kind of the blue-collar people. You know, they weren't Sadducees who come from the priestly line, who are, you know, sad, you see, because they don't believe in the afterlife and they don't believe in angels and demons, right? That's how you remember the difference between the two of them. The Pharisees were more of the blue-collar, kind of in the trenches with people, kind of people. But we, based on what we've read in the New Testament, tend to associate the Pharisees in such a way of upright, you know, overly zealous in their righteousness. So we already have these assumptions. What are your assumptions about tax collectors? The opposite of the Pharisee. Yeah, that's exactly right. Quite the opposite. What, somebody else did something?
Collaborators
with the Romans, right? They were kind of traitors a little bit to their own people. They were the ones that collected taxes, and they kind of would collect as whatever they had to pay back to Rome, but then a little bit more off the top to, you know, put in their own little pockets there. So they're typically not viewed very well, especially in our reading. That's what the assumption is going to be. But in the first century, when this parable was spoken, that would have been the assumption too, right? Like, there was a negative connotation with the tax collector. But in the first century, there was probably a positive connotation with the Pharisee, at least in a Jewish setting, because they were the ones who were, again, blue collar, and they'd spent their life studying scripture and dedicating themselves to worship. And so you have this kind of dichotomy set up from the very beginning, right? These are our assumptions. And so we're gonna look here through Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14 is what we're going to study. The interesting thing is I'm not going to give you verse 9 yet. We're going to jump right into the parable, which begins in verse 10. So hear now these words from Luke chapter 18, verses 10 through 13. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, was praying thus, "God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all my income." But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even look up to heaven, but was beating his breast and saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." Let that settle. That's the parable that we get in its original form without the introduction of that first verse 9. So we're going to go kind of line by line through this and break this down a little bit. Remember, context is important, right? This line I keep saying that any scripture, the text without context is just a pretext for it to say whatever you want it to say, right? I keep saying this week in and week out. So we're going to break this down kind of line by line a little bit here. The first thing that we see is they go to the temple. Two people go to the temple. And it's hard for us to kind of place ourselves in the context of this. One of the many books I've been reading about parables, the author says it's a better modern day equivalent would be like if a pope and a pimp went to St. Peter's, which is a lot of peas. And kind of offensive, right? Well, would the pope be sitting next to a pimp praying in St. Peter's? Maybe, this pope especially, right? But I think that's the point, right? This should be the uneasiness that you get a little bit in what's going on here. Clearly there's a dichotomy being set. And yet, the temple is the place both of them go, and both of them are welcome. Don't miss that. The temple is the place where both go. Both are welcome. Both go to say prayers. I assume, I'm making assumptions here, both go to find reconciliation. Both go to praise and to pray, to worship God. So even though we set up a dichotomy, in all actuality, they're both going with the same idea or agenda to go to the temple. So then you have a Pharisee, which we've talked about a little bit. And you have a tax collector. The Pharisee standing by himself, was praying this. So when I took Old Testament over, or Hebrew Scriptures over at Perkins, one semester I got to take it with Dr. Heller. And Dr. Heller, one of his favorite sayings was, every translation is an interpretation. And so for those who study with me regularly, you've heard this a million times. Every translation is an interpretation. And we're going to see that here in this text. Another important line that I think is really interesting, and I think it comes from Tillich, but I couldn't actually find the saying, Paul Tillich, is that theology is in the prepositions. And so here we have the Pharisee standing by himself was praying this, thus. So prepositions are tricky. In Greek, they can be tricky. In English as well. But look at how these are translated in different versions. So the NRSV is what we've been reading. The Pharisee standing by himself was praying thus. But in the Common English Bible, you get the Pharisee stood and prayed about himself with these words. A little different. And then look at what the NASB, the New American Standard Bible, does. The Pharisee stood and was praying this to himself. And then the King James gives you, the Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself. So Amy G. Levine, I mentioned a couple weeks ago, is a scholar at Vanderbilt. She's Jewish, but she teaches New Testament, which is fascinating, and I love it. What she does in her book on parables is really tries to open them up so readers can see them from more of a first century understanding and a Jewish understanding as well. And she says so often what happens in Christian circles is that parables end up being used against Judaism as a whole. And in the same way that, just think of the negative connotation we've associated with Pharisees, often that gets exacerbated to being anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic sometimes even as well. So she translates it as the Pharisee standing by or to himself, these things prayed. And even that, I love that she couldn't even pick, right? She recognizes the ambiguity of the preposition and chooses both by and to, which even if you read either one of those, it changes the meaning to some extent. Theology is in the prepositions. We're not done with prepositions. We will come to more of them shortly. So the Pharisee standing by or to or with himself, praying to whatever you want to say, says thus, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people. God, I thank you that I'm not like other people. Again, what is your what's your first feeling you get when you hear that? Yes, you are. Yes, you are. That's funny. You do kind of get, I don't want to speak for you, but typically I feel like you get kind of a sense of, you know, nose in the air, like, look how cool I am. Look how good I am. Look how righteous I am. Smug, that's a good word. But notice, who's his prayer directed to? God. God, I thank you that I'm not like other people. Yeah, Clay.
Is that true in one where it says he was praying to himself? He was praying to himself, God, I thank you?
So that's a great question. And this is where every translation is an interpretation. Because if that's the case, then you're bordering, or not bordering, you are in idolatry at that point, right? And that's what I think Dr. Levine is pointing to, is that when you translate it in such a way, you're getting to the anti-Semitic understanding, whereas in the original, what her original understanding of the text would be, is that's not the point. That's not what's being done here. But again, every translation is an interpretation, so it doesn't seem to be the case with the rest of the reading, but we'll... But it could be. Yeah, and that's what the NASB does. Yeah.
Well, another way to hear that praying to himself is like praying so that nobody else could hear.
Right. It could be directed toward himself so nobody... That's right. Yeah, go ahead.
I think inflection can be a really big deal here.
Exactly.
Because I'm thinking what he's saying, God, I thank you that I am not like other people.
That's right.
In other words, I realize that it's only by grace that I'm superior.
Absolutely. It's only by grace that I'm superior. What? So well put. So well put. And you said very present. And this is an important thing to know about Pharisees. Pharisees both believed in free will, but also not so much determinism, but a little bit of the idea of fate. And I have some examples for you, because at the core of this is a prayer of gratitude, right? If you just take that, God, I thank you, that's a prayer of gratitude. Now, you can look at it and say, well, the rest of it kind of makes you think gratitude for a righteous person. But look at some other prayers that we see from Judaism. I give thanks to thee, O Lord my God, that thou hast given me my lot with those who sit in the seat of learning and not with those who sit at the street corners. For I am early to work, and they are early to work. I am early to work on words of the Torah, and they are early to work on things of no moment. And that's in the Babylonian Talmud. So again, is this something that is a self-righteousness, or look how much better I am than you? Or is it a prayer of gratitude, recognizing that I was given the opportunity to be a Pharisee, or I was given the opportunity to study Torah, which, you know, Dr. Abraham said, anybody can study quantum physics. It takes somebody really special to study scriptures, right? Like this is the best work you could ever do in your entire life, is to study the work of the scriptures. And maybe there's, like the Pharisee, right? Maybe it's a little bit of fate and a little bit of free will. But don't lose the fact that there is gratitude that is being portrayed in this. I'm not done. Here's one more. Well, actually, I have two more, but here's the next one. This one you're going to get a kick out of. Rabbi Judah says, a man must recite three benedictions every day. Blessed be you, Lord, who did not make me a Gentile. Blessed be you, Lord, who did not make me uneducated. Blessed be you, Lord, who did not make me a woman. That wouldn't, Jane says, that wouldn't go over well today. So, again, we can look at this and say, well, how dare they, right? Blessed be you who did not make me a Gentile. Well, but here's the thing about the Gentiles. They don't have the law. And those who are uneducated are ignorant to the law. And this is what the reasoning often is in Judaism. And women don't have time to study the law because they have busier work, and some would say more important work, to rear children and to bring up the household. And yet, blessed be you, God, who has given me this work. I'm not a Gentile, I'm not uneducated, and I'm not a woman. This is what you have put before me. To which I got this out of Amy Delevingne's book, and she said, I don't buy it, but you could see that they're trying to justify the argument of it, right? She said her five-year-old son learned this whenever he was in a Jewish school, and she said, why do you think that you learned that? And that's basically what he said was, well, you know, we can't control everything, and this is just a lot I've been given in life, that I'm not a Gentile, I'm not uneducated, and I'm not a woman, so I got to take this seriously. She was like, well, at least they're trying. Yes, ma'am. And there, yes, there's very much a dichotomy that's set up, right? Kind of a dualistic thinking of there's this way or there's that way. Which again, back to our parable, is a very similar setup, right? There's a Pharisee and there's a tax collector. Two opposite ends of this, somebody said earlier, right? The opposite version of this, right? But don't lose that this was just something that happened in Jewish faith, because we get this idea also when Jesus prayed, I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and have revealed them to infants. Right? Like there's a bit of fate falling in that as well, right? Like this isn't just something that we only find in the rabbis and in the Talmud. And those, like this is something in our very own scriptures that we see, and leaves us to the question of, well, why would God hide these things from the intelligent and the wise? At one point, and we just lost it when we became wise and intelligent. Yeah, and it makes you question, is this prescriptive or descriptive? And this is what we do with the parables, right? We begin to question all of these things. But okay, we press on. Maybe. There we go. So God, I thank you that I'm not like other people. Those other people being thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. So the first two are very interesting words that are chosen by the NRSV. Adulterers is pretty well agreed upon across the board. And even this tax collector in the Greek is agreed upon as well. The first two are a little bit more tricky. NRSV says thieves and rogues. The Common English Bible says crooks and evildoers. The New American Standard Bible says swindlers and unjust. The King James Version says extortioners and unjust, but then comes and says publican rather than tax collector. And then Amy Jill in her book says those who are greedy or unrighteous. And you may think, well, those are all synonyms, right? There's a comma. Did I miss a comma somewhere? Okay, there should be a comma. So swindlers, comma, unjust, comma, adulterer. So these are three different descriptions of these people that he's categorizing, this Pharisee is. Now, you may not think a whole lot of it, but this term unjust that's used in a couple of these translations is basically the opposite of righteous. And this is going to be very important to us once we get a full picture of the parable as a whole. So sit on that word. We're going to come back to it as well. The interesting thing about this term also, does anybody know what parable is right before this in the Gospel of Luke? It's the parable of the persistent widow, also termed the parable of the unjust judge. In that story, which is found in a couple different Gospels, this parable we're looking at right now is only found in the Gospel according to Luke. And I told you a couple weeks ago, you know, Luke is a little bit tricky. Sometimes he domesticates the parables a little bit. We're going to look at that here in a second too. But the best example of his domestication is the parable of the unjust judge, where he ends up making it all about praying, which is something, you know, just pray persistently and you'll end up getting what you want. But that's not what we find in Mark. Mark doesn't add the aspect of praying. Either way, this term unjust in the story right before, right context, in the story right before the parable looking at now is in reference to a judge who neither fears God or respects people. That's what the parable keeps saying about this judge. A judge who neither fears God nor respects people. That same term is used here in this description. Okay, we're building. So what does he pray for then, right? What is he giving thanks for? What does he say about himself? I fast twice a week, give a tenth of all my income. What does that tell you about him? He's proud. He follows the law. He goes above and beyond the law. Because nowhere in the text, in the Hebrew scriptures, does it say that a person should fast twice a week. It says once a week. He goes over and above. Nowhere in the scriptures does it say give a tenth of all of your income. Depending on where you read in the Hebrew scriptures is depending upon how much of your tenth should be given. Don't tell Paul that I said this, right? But nowhere does it say all of your income. So you can imagine if other Pharisees are hearing this story or are present when the story is being told, the smirk on their face they probably get, right? Yeah, this dude, he's like a Pharisee of all Pharisees, right? He's like back to the original, like back to Abraham, who did give a tenth of everything, of all of his everything that he owned to Melchizedek. Like, this guy is taking it seriously and doing it. He has a little bit to be proud of, right? Again, back to free will. He has made the choice to do these things, as opposed to the tax collector who has made the choice to what? Definitely not do these things, right? So again, no text requires this. It's the new Abraham. The Pharisee's prayer is a caricature and might have brought a smile even to the other Pharisees who were standing by. Again, a caricature. Don't lose that, right? Like there's something taking place here that's leading us to something bigger. And I like this quote. I wanted to share this quote with you too. There's no requirement for twice a week fasting, meritorious acts perform on behalf of the community, vicariously making atonement for the sins of the people by fasting twice a week. That's what this Etta Linneman said. She said, what could actually be happening here is not even is this person really proud of himself for all that he's done. He could be doing things on behalf of the rest of the community, recognizing that they don't have the opportunity to do it. Yeah.
He said this aloud.
Mm-hmm. Right, to himself. That's and so it's a good question. That's one that you have to wrestle with. Was he saying this to himself or was he saying it out loud? What right.
Jesus makes note of how the Pharisees had a habit of saying long prayers to be heard by others.
It's again, understanding Pharisees is very complicated, especially in Luke. Because some of the other Gospels are a little bit pretty harsh on Pharisees. Luke's Gospel, you get a mixed bag. Jesus does refer to them as greedy, which in here we think like that doesn't fit with the parable that's being told. It's also important to note, this is the only place in any of the Gospels where one of the characters of a parable is actually a Pharisee. So Jesus at some point says they're greedy. At other points we find Pharisees who invite Jesus to come dine with them. We find who is it that warns Jesus of Herod's plan? The Pharisees. So you get this mixed bag in Luke's gospel of are they good or are they bad or are they just Pharisees? And sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad. Like most people.
If the trend of the day was to say your prayers in an elitist type style, isn't he just following the trend of the day?
Could be just following the trend of the day. Yeah. Again, these are things that the actual story doesn't fully spill out for us that we're left filling in the gaps. And just remember, however you fill in the gap is a judgment on the Pharisee. Okay. Keep going. So after we get I'm not like these other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector, right? Like, this is the one, and all the commentaries that I read and all the work that I've tried to do to understand this parable, this is the one statement where they say, okay, this may have been where he went too far. And the actual comparing, the specificity of his comparison with the person who's standing somewhere in his general vicinity, right? Because again, if you look at where it says that the tax collector was standing far off, how far off? We don't know. But some relation to them, right? This is the only place where he's extremely criticized, or there's been a lot of criticism for his specificity in this. Yeah, go ahead, Jane.
We are assuming that he's saying this out loud so the tax collector can hear.
That's still an assumption. Mm-hmm. I mean, the text is there, right? Standing by himself, was praying thus.
Always assume he knew the tax collector personally.
You always assume he knew the tax collector personally? Well, that changed. What's that? If he's saying it out loud, he knew the
tax collector. That's what I always thought.
You always assumed it was his tax collector. And that really personalizes the story then, doesn't it? His congressman, that's right. Unless he knew him personally, how would he know he's tax collector? That's a great question. No. Do you see the beauty of the parable? Isn't this fun? Yeah.
Interesting that Jesus chose a tax collector to be one of his disciples,
right? Right. And then what happens with Zacchaeus as well, right? I mean, there's a theme in the Gospels with tax collectors. We, thousands of years later, get to look back at it, and we typically view the tax collector as the hero role. The problem is, the first century, that was the farthest from the truth, right? Because why a hero? Because usually they're the one that has the dramatic change. In the stories. No. Sorry. But the kind of underlying assumption in our heads typically, because we've so grown up on this, is that we know the Pharisee stands in this place of self-righteousness, and we know the tax collector stands here, and woe him is going to make some dramatic change in his life. We already have that assumption in our head because we've grown up with these stories.
So we should rather think of the aggressive and obnoxious IRS agent.
You said it, not me. think again, one of the translations I mentioned earlier was extortioner. Now, is that a term that is actually being used toward the tax collector? Maybe. Like, there's a reason that the person, when they said the Pope and the pimp, uses a pimp. Because it's somebody who uses other people for their own gain. Like, tax collectors were not viewed well, and you may know that in your head, but you also know where they're going to get to. Don't miss that first part of it. They were not viewed well because they did not do anything to benefit the community, typically speaking, and they only did things to benefit themselves, typically speaking. Yeah. Sure. And this is what, when you really mind in on the parable, it should wreck your understanding of the assumption you have of the Pharisee, and it should start to wreck your understanding of the assumption you have about tax collectors, which we'll get to, right? Why tax collectors? Well, let's focus in. Let's hone in here on the tax collector. So, tax collector is standing far off, right? I said this. What's the proximity? We're not entirely sure. He says he's standing far off. Why would he stand far off? Shame. I always assume shame as well. Potentially an outcast, right? Maybe he is shamed by the community. Who? What was that? Bob, are you making comments in the back? he's worried because that Pharisee's mumbling things. Yeah. Because nobody wants to stand with a tax collector. Jane, I think the more I studied this, the more I thought that's exactly what it is. Nobody wants to stand with a tax collector. If you walked into St. Peter's and the Pope was there and the pimp was there, which one are you going to go pray by? Depends on the Pope. Funny. Funny. Based on his profession, based on his vocation, he walks around with a letter on his head, metaphorically speaking, right? Like, how did they know it was? Probably they knew him because he was their tax collector. People knew who he was, they knew what he did, and they knew the way tax collectors treated people. Yeah.
In the context of the time, the tax collectors were taxing everybody out of their lands. They were very oppressive, they were keeping them up. So there's no question they were villains in the city because they were becoming wealth and they were actually defranchising everybody. All the farms were going, so they were legitimate.
Yeah. That's right. A terrible image. A terrible, terrible image. That's right. They'd sold out to the Roman Empire and had become traitors to their people. So is this why he's standing far off? Yet this is the prayer that he prays. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. If a pope and a pimp were standing there, what kind of prayer would you expect a pimp to pray? That's a lot of P's. Right? What's that? Thanks. Think about that, though. You have tax collectors in your mind, right? There's been somebody who's been brewing in the back of your mind the whole time we've been working through this parable. When you see those people in church and you think, what are they doing here? What's the prayer that you think they're praying? Are they just showing up because it's what they, you know, think they're supposed to do? Or are they praying a prayer of, God, be merciful to me, a sinner? Everybody could say that. And isn't that part of the beauty of this parable too? Is that everybody could say that prayer. You know what? Turns out everybody can say a prayer of gratitude too. You know what? It turns out everybody has the right to go to the temple to pray. Isn't there a really beautiful equality in the midst of this parable that has this dichotomy set up of the Pharisee and the tax collector? Remember how I talked about the Catholicity that Robert Capone talked about? This is something that reaches out to everybody. The problem becomes we start to ask questions like, can somebody like this really receive God's mercy? Or even maybe we start questioning ourselves, well, he may be praying that prayer now, but what's he going to do tomorrow when he goes back to work? Or is he going to go back to work at all? You know, sometimes a prayer like this can only be followed with a change in vocation. Why? Because if he is really earnest in his prayer and in praying this, and assume, right, we don't know, let's just assume his heart is transformed, could he ever go back? Could never go back to abusing the community from which he comes from. Let's just sit with that, right? Like, that's a question that's good for us to ask. Okay, let's go back to the beginning, because remember I didn't give you the first verse. So the first verse, I told you that Luke often domesticates. This is Luke's intro to this parable. And see a little bit of the setup that takes place here. He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. Well, now, doesn't that influence the reading of the parable? That sets a stage for you to make some assumptions. The parable in itself may not make those same assumptions, but the setup gives us this assumption. So a lot of scholars will say, this is Luke's framing the parable to domesticate it a little bit. It's up to you to decide whether that's true or not. But clearly, it throws some shade or some understanding toward how you would understand this parable. So having read this, right, he also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. Hear now again the whole parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, one a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, was praying thus, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all my income. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even look up to heaven, but was beating his breast and saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And hear now the conclusion. The last verse. I tell you, this man went down to his home justified rather than the other. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, but all who humble themselves will be exalted. Okay, let's start with the very last statement first. This, again, typically scholastically is viewed as Luke's addition to the parable. Why? Well, primarily because it's called a floating statement. This is a statement that's used in multiple different places. So was it original to this parable? Maybe. Or was it just a piece of wisdom, kind of like a proverb, but a Jewish wisdom that was used to tack on to different stories, like we see here in Luke 14 and in Matthew 23. This idea of those who exalt themselves will be humbled and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Was it original to this text? Or is it just something that Luke tacks on at the end? Let's look at this word justified. Justified means to show to be or declared righteous. To be declared righteous. It's the only time in the Gospels this word is used referencing an individual. That should be important. Only time this is used in reference to an individual. There's also a wordplay that's going on here. We're not reading this in the original Greek, but if you did, that opening statement, he also told this parable to those who trusted themselves that they were righteous. And then remember the list of people that he was saying, I thank you that I'm not like these, right? Those thieves, those rogues, that term rogue. And then in this very last statement, this man went down to his home justified. It's all this root word of righteous, which you can see there in the Greek, right? I'm not going to pretend to try to pronounce those words in Greek because I didn't study Greek. I just trust those people who did study Greek that they know what they're doing. But you can see, right? Even the A in front of that in the second word there, it's like the anti. Those who believe trusted themselves to be righteous, those who the unjust, that's the term, right? It was unjust, or Amy J. Levine translated as unrighteous, the opposite of righteous. Somebody just said, who's the opposite of the Pharisee? The tax collector. You see what's happening here? It's a wordplay. And this is the man who goes down justified. Okay. Remember, I said we were going to get back to another preposition. this preposition holds the whole thing in balance. You feel like you got a good grasp on the parable? Get ready. And then we're going to be done. This is the last thing. Rather than, it's a preposition. It comes from this word, para. Where have we heard the word para before? Parable, paradox, parallel. Meaning from beside, by the side, by or beside. Okay? Everywhere in the New Testament, this word para is translated one something similar to this, and only right here and in Romans 1:25 do we get the idea of it being translated to rather than. Only two places in all of Scripture is it translated rather than. It could also be translated as contrary to. Those are the two potential ones that it could be. But read this closing statement again if it was translated using some of the other statements. This man went down to his home justified beside the other. Not rather than the other, but beside the other. This man went down to his home justified by the side of the other. This man went down to his home justified with the other. Hold on, it gets better. This man went down to his home justified by the other. By meaning by the other. This man went down to his home justified because of the other. Theology's in the prepositions. What a drastic difference the parable means if we have because of instead of rather than. And you may think, well, that's not fair to just change the translation of it. Every translation is an interpretation, right? So this is how Amy G. Levine says it. To you I say, descending to his house, this one is justified alongside that one. And she says this real fast and we're done. Judaism is a communitarian movement in which people pray in the plural. We just prayed earlier. Our Father, give us this day, forgive us, in which each member of the community is responsible for the other. This concern for community responsibility means that the sin of one person can negatively impact everyone else. At the same time, it means that the good deeds of one person can have a positive impact on the lives of others. And then she talks about this idea, zakut avot, merits of our ancestors. It's a stored up protection. And you may think, well, okay, fine, but we don't get that in our scriptures. Well, sure we do. Remember the Syrophoenician woman who went to Jesus and wanted her daughter healed? And Jesus says, not, you know, I came for the Jews, like the, and he basically calls her a dog, and she says, but even the dogs eat the scraps of the he says, your faith has healed her. That's my translation. Go back and read it for yourselves, though. And then think of the guy who his friends brought him and lowered him down to the roof. Jesus forgives his sins first and then heals him, but before all of that, he says, when he saw their faith, he forgave this person's sins and then healed him. Don't think that our scriptures are foreign to this idea that you are indeed your brother and sister's keeper. And this lies the trap in the parable. We ask, who is justified in this? Is it just the tax collector? Is it the Pharisee also, whose works may have, whose deeds, whatever that word, I can't pronounce it right now, may have been atoning work for his community already? To negatively judge one and promote the other puts you right in the trap of the parable. The assumptions you make about the Pharisee puts you in the trap of this. Thank you, God, that I am not like that Pharisee. And then the question becomes, will we limit God's grace? Will we limit God's grace? Will we be offended by the mercy of God? Or recognize that in as much as the tax collector needs God's mercy, I also need God's mercy. And yet, in as much as the Pharisee is righteous, I also am called to live righteous. See, they're caricatures because you shouldn't fully associate yourself with the Pharisee and you shouldn't fully associate yourself with the tax collector, but you should recognize that you're somewhere in between. And sometimes you're going to lean more one way and sometimes you're going to lean more the other way. And the beauty of it is God's grace covers all of that. If you allow it. Now, there's a really great modern explanation of this in the middle school group project that we're not going to get to because we're running out of time. But maybe that's for another day. Thank you all for having me. It's been a joy to be here. Blessings.